When I became a believer, there was no Messianic Judaism at that time. This is around 1971. There were Jewish believers, but no, with no self-conscious Jewish identity. You know what I mean? So I went to a church, and there was no other place. But the pastor happened to be a research associate at the Cornell Space and Radiophysics Center. And this guy, whose name was Eccleman, actually designed a camera which the astronauts went to the moon left up there. So he was really quite a guy. And maybe you've heard the name Carl Sagan. Well, he was in the office upstairs, and he was a big antagonist because he didn't like faith. But what was important to me in the very early days and really set a trajectory was I had to know if there were facts that backed up this radical claim, which, and I know this is true for many of you, for me, cost me a lot. I mean, when I was a kid, I have to tell you, I was the golden boy, not just in our immediate family, but the whole extended family, the aunts and uncles, and there were lots of cousins doing different things, but because I was a musician or for whatever reasons, they thought, oh, this kid, you know. And then when I became a follower of Yeshua, the relationship with my family cracked with a loud crack. I mean, really cracked big time. So I'll tell you what my father said to my youngest brother, who's my brother Jared. They said to him, and I quote, "You are our last hope." Now, we laugh at it this end, but back then, whoa, you know, the golden boy, But what sustained me over all those years was just a real conviction, among other things, but I'm going somewhere with this, that really this stuff was true. And I read about these things, and they were really important to me. Later on, around 1981 or 2, I got very interested in another whole area of very suggestive evidence for Yeshua's resurrection, and that was the Shroud of Turin. Very interesting. And I know that there was some debunking done several years ago because they found that carbon dating said it was from the 1200s, but actually what they have found is that they dated a little section of cloth that was added after a fire in the 1200s, but that the three-dimensionality of the image is really unparalleled. And so these things, and I don't want to talk a whole lot about them, but very, very important. However, what I want to say to you is that knowing evidences, I call them evidences, or you call them, well, evidence is a good word, it's not enough. It's not enough. So what I want to speak with you today about is what's not enough, and then what will take us into the realm of enough. So that's where we're going. Now, again, evidences are important. There's a book I want to recommend to you by Colin Humphreys called The Miracles of Exodus, which, if you've read it, it's a dynamite book. He's the head of material science at Cambridge University. So he's a heavy hitter, Colin. And we've become kind of friends by email. But this guy is, you know, top world scientist. And he's done work on the Exodus, and actually, with the help of previous work that had been done, found that if you look at the plagues of Egypt, they actually fit a very observable pattern in the rhythms of Egyptian ecology and Egyptian's climate, but everything was souped up, and everything happened when Moses said it should happen. So I'll just give you a little bit of this. You know, he suggests that when it talks about the sea, the Nile becoming red, that was, in his construction, an algae bloom, which kills all the fish and makes the water undrinkable, and the fish die, and it's stinking and whatnot. And because of that, the death of the fish and the toxic environment, frogs, which, and this happens around September, October, frogs, it's a time of a lot of frogs. It's a frog convention. Kermit shows up, you know, everyone's there, the whole gang is there, Kermit the frog is there, but seriously, this is a time that we know was a time that there were a lot of frogs. However, the frogs, not having their ability to eat what they normally would, and having this toxic environment, came up on the land, and they died. Of course, the scripture talks about this, and you had heaps of dead frogs, and that gives occasion to gnats and what are called staple flies, which are very painful, the bite of them is very painful, and that results in gnats and staple flies, and that's the second and third place. And then you go on, and I don't want to talk about this too much more, but the picture is that you do have a very accurate historical recollection in the biblical narrative. And that's important, again, for our point, though it's not enough, it's good to know that when you read the text, you're not just reading recollections of people living centuries and centuries later, concocting an early history of Israel that has no basis in reality. You follow what I'm saying on that? Yeah, it's pretty important, but again, it is not enough. So, then we move into our Besorah portion, and beginning with the portion last week, and you recall that we talked about the feeding of, well, it's called the 5,000, but actually, back then, they didn't count women in the equation, and kids. So I'm estimating, I call it the feeding of the 10,000 plus. I mean, there were, so you're talking about Yeshua as gaining a regional following. A lot of people, crowds are very volatile, especially when they're hungry, and the disciples were worried, and we talked about this last week, you recall from my message. And so there is this miracle of Yeshua feeding all these people, and no problem. God can do miracles, and we just have no problem with that. Yeshua can do those things. If he wants to suspend the normal laws of physics temporarily, what's the big deal? He created them. Why can't he step out of them? Why can't, you know, it really is no big deal. We have trouble with it because of a philosophical overlay from the Enlightenment, you know, down to today, and we have trouble with it. But shouldn't have any trouble with it at all. He wants to do a miracle, he can do it. There's no problem. And Yeshua, being the person he was able to do this. So the question then becomes, why did Yeshua criticize them? Why did he criticize the people who came to seek him out at Capernaum, as we read in our Besorah portion? You recall that what happened was, after the miracle of the feeding of all those people, they wanted to make him melech, they wanted to make him king. They figured, look, we've been waiting for God to get rid of those Romans. This has got to be the guy, and they wanted to take him by force and make him their political ruler. And one day he will be that kind of political ruler, but not this time around. And so he withdraws and goes to a lonely place. His followers get into a boat, and likely the crowd thought that they were going to go to Tiberias, which was the most likely nearby town to where this miracle likely occurred. We don't know for sure, but likely. But instead, they're on their way up to Capernaum, which is further up on the coast, quite a ways up on the coast of the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee. And then Yeshua, again, suspends the laws of nature. Again, I don't see any reason to take this as any kind of metaphor for something. I think he just suspended the laws of nature. And when you read, and let me say this parenthetically, when you read the Gospel of John, when you read it, you've got to keep an eye on things that occurred in the Tanakh. You see what I mean? So much of Yohanan evoke images and ideas and things that occurred earlier on. So here, what we might, but I think we can see quite clearly, is a kind of reference to the flood and Noah's ark being suspended in the midst of the storm, if you will. And Yeshua comes and he enters the boat and makes everything fine. So that reference seems rather obvious. But again, the question is this: when he came to Capernaum, or call it English Capernaum, when he got there, people got to have come in their boats, and they found him. And he says this: when they found him on the other side of the lake, they asked him, "Rabbi, when did you get here?" And because they never saw him leave, and so they asked, "When did you get here? We were looking for you back in the Tiberias area, and we didn't see you go. And here you are. So when did you get here?" Yeshua answered. He says to them, "Very truly I say to you, you were looking for me, not because you saw the signs I performed, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill." Now, different translations handle it slightly differently. This translation I would take issue with, because it really does make it seem is that Yeshua is upset at them because they had fleshly concerns instead of spiritual concerns. You only came to find me because you've got something from me, you've got some food. But, you know, that was the only reason. That was the only reason. Not because of the signs I performed. I would like to suggest a different, an alternative explanation of that little passage. I want to suggest that Yeshua is not at all critiquing or criticizing the fact that he provided food for them. Don't forget, you've got to read this with first century Jewish eyes, not modern eyes. And after centuries and centuries of the interpretive tradition on this passage being a kind of separation of body and spirit and all, but that really is not natural to the biblical text, I think he's not criticizing at all the fact that they were fed and that was a good thing and that they should want that from God. After all, that's the kind of stuff that the Messiah was promised, had promised that he would do. I think the key is in the word here, you saw the signs I performed. Not because you saw the signs, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. He's not criticizing the fact that they were filled and that they wanted food and that they got food. That isn't it. What we have to talk about, and this is the key to all I want to say today, we have to talk about this word signs. Signs. See, the idea here is there is a kind of difference between a miracle and a sign. And this is subtle, but I think you're going to get it, but it really, really is important. The idea is that they didn't get the meaning of his having performed this miracle in his role as a kind of Moses figure who provides bread for the people. The bread being even better than manna. Manna, it's okay, but bread, I mean, that's really good. And they didn't get the sign value. You see, a sign is something that happens that points us to something greater. That's the nature of a sign. In Hebrew, it's the word ot, or in Greek, semion, but it's the critical word is ot. Sign. It's something that when we experience should have implications for us that take us to a higher place. Again, he's not criticizing the fact that they like being fed. He's saying, you didn't get the sign value of what I was doing. You see, the sign value was to take you to a level of understanding of who I am. That is the issue. Who I am. The sign points to Yeshua and his Messiahship. Who he is as the Son of Man, and you recall that allusion is to the book of Daniel, chapter 7. The Son of Man, it's not just, doesn't primarily mean Son of Man, meaning I, as the great Messiah, am a human being like you. That's not the essence of it. The allusion is to the great person in Daniel 7 who appears before God, the Ancient of Days, and who's given an everlasting kingdom. See? That's the Son of Man. And what they didn't get, and this is why he criticizes them when they finally arrive in their boats at Capernaum home, he says, what you didn't get is who I am. You've got to see the sign, the signs that I'm doing, the indications that point to something greater. That is what a sign is. And when we get a hold of that, there, the people in those days were looking for someone to rescue them from the repressive Roman regime with all of its capriciousness and heavy-handedness. And we, in our day, are pretty upset about the fact that in the Middle East right now, you have Russian planes and Chinese ships and American special forces and all these people, and it sounds like you could have a Sarajevo in 1914. You know, you could have a... you could have some accident that could create a huge problem. And maybe you, like me, are not thrilled about all the candidates running for president right now. You know what I mean? And so, you know, all of that calls us to say, man, we want the Son of Man. We want him, you know? So that is the problem, was they didn't see the implications of the Son, that he's the Son of Man described by Daniel, this, that he is the very expression of God's very reality, who is even more powerful than the laws of nature, and hence he can create out of nothing, but out of a few fish, he can create hundreds and hundreds of them, loaves, and he can suspend the laws of gravity so that he can walk on the water and not, you know, what would normally happen, go into the drink, that because of who he is, the sign points to who he is. And for us, this is the critical thing. Knowing the evidences is great, but it's not enough. Believing, as a matter of historical record, that he did these things, it's great. We believe it, it's true, but it's not enough. What's important is the sign value. What is this saying to us? What is the message embedded in these mighty acts? So, we could phrase it this way. What is the goal of life? The goal of life arises from our understanding of the signs that he provides. What's the goal of life? It's to love the God of Israel with all our heart, soul, and might, learning how to keep Torah. For us Messianic Jews, this includes growing in our love and appreciation of God's supreme revelation, Yeshua the Messiah. When you get that, you got the meaning of the sign. Am I being at all clear or being very
obvious?
You get what I'm saying?
Yes.
So here's the point. Here's the point. When you get the sign, here's where it goes. Get to know him. Get to know him in this context as a first century Jew. Get to know him as the most unique person who has ever lived. Get to know him as the supernatural person he truly is, the co-creator of all that exists, who at the same time has the ability and the willingness to be your and my best friend. Isn't that the coolest thing? It is the best. So, what is enough? Let the signs take you where they, the evidence, that the signs take you where they go. He's the best, and living for his interests and for the sake of things that are important to him, like community building and all the other things, that is the meaning of life. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.